have with us in the studios once again, Jov Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning. I'm on a time delay.
Okay. I was gonna say, some mornings it's like pulling
teeth.
Let me
adjust that switch.
Yeah.
So let's get going. No more of this chit chat. You couldn't miss it from this week's TV and newspaper coverage. Tacoma police chief seemed to be and his wife, who is still with us, was making big headlines.
Yeah, for the people who don't know the story, David Brame, the police chief of Tacoma, had been going through a messy divorce with his wife, Crystal Brame, who had filed papers in court for divorce, and she took her two children with her. She had alleged that he had been threatening her with his gun and trying to strangle her, in short, domestic violence. And then just this week, David Brame just by chance met up with his wife in a Gig Harbor shopping mall and shot her in the head and then shot himself.
Which was just by chance something he happened to spontaneously do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He couldn't see his wife's car and then decide to just go on his merry way. He had to stop in the same parking lot with her, get in the car with her, with his gun, which is something he normally didn't carry on his off hours, but he was happening to carry with him that day, and get into an argument with her, according to witnesses, and then shoot her and shoot himself. Crystal is still alive in the hospital,
with his 5 and 8 year old children
in the next car over
and coming running toward them and essentially witnessing it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this leaves open the question of how did this guy first of all get to be Tacoma police chief, especially since now that he's dead, the barriers have opened up and this whole flood of information has come out that he was accused of rape in 1988 and that his close friend on the force, who has known him since he was a child, believes that he did it. And a number of people on the force knew, and it was office gossip, that he had raped this woman and that a former police chief had covered up for him.
And that it happened while he was in the process of going through a very contentious first divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was the same sort of situation in terms of mental stress and that sort of thing.
And then it comes out just a day or two ago that in his personnel file in 1981, when he had interviewed for the job, a police psychologist had written on the application that he should not be hired, that he was unfit to be a police officer, and yet he was hired anyway, most likely because his father and his brother were also on the force at the time. So all along the line, we see these people who are covering up for this guy. First, there was the person who hired him in spite of his poor evaluation. There was Ray Fietlin, the police chief who covered up the investigation into the 1988 rape. There was Tacoma Police Captain Dave Olson, who investigated that rape and who said that he thought Brame was guilty as sin, and yet Olson remained quiet as Brame moved up through the ranks and became police chief. There was Reggie Roberts, a police officer and very close childhood friend of Brame, who also believed that he did it because Brame had admitted to him that he had raped this woman, and yet Roberts remained silent as Brame applied for the job of police chief and got it. There was city manager Ray Corpus, who is now going to be up in front of the city council, the Tacoma City Council, who are going to be looking at this whole mess and see if maybe Corpus hadn't made some kind of very, very bad mistake by not looking at Brame's personnel file. He said that he didn't read the personnel file before he hired him as police chief.
And not only is his job on the line, but the interim police chief has also now stepped aside.
Catherine Woodard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. because of his inability to conduct an impartial investigation and his closeness.
She made plenty of excuses for him, Brame.
Over a period of years.
Yeah, and Crystal Brame claimed that Catherine Woodard had made threats against her. Also, there's Pat France, the head of Tacoma's police union, who criticized the media for supposedly pushing Brame over the edge by printing stories about his messy divorce in the PI.
And by the way, Brame was the previous head of the police union in Tacoma.
Really? I didn't know that. That's interesting. France would go to bat for him.
Yeah, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment, because the police union was also an entity that covered up for him over the years.
Yeah, and then France also went ahead and made this violent threat against the sort of independent journalist who puts out the new Tacoman, a little independent rag in Tacoma, who was following and broke the story of Brame's divorce to the media and the domestic violence allegations. He had called up this guy and made this threat: if you want to throw stones, you'd better live in a bulletproof glass house.
And that was not anything got him in any particular trouble either.
No, and well, France is on paid administrative leave and has said that he made a mistake when he did that, but he's not going to suffer for it. But it really shows you what kind of atmosphere is going on in the Tacoma Police Department, that Brame was an abusive personality. He was the police chief, and he sanctioned that kind of behavior by his officers, because it's coming out now.
And it's really been coming out day by day by day over the past week, to the point where, you know, in the Seattle papers on the first day, it was kind of not very highlighted in the local section. And, you know, every day the placement's been getting a little bit more forefront, in part because the TV stations have been really pretty exploitative about it. But there are two aspects to this that are very, very troubling, that are much broader than the tragedy of Brame himself. And one of those, well, three if you count how media cover police affairs, but one of them is the relatively high incidence of domestic violence and violence incidents in general involving police departments and law enforcement personnel and military personnel, people, primarily men, who not just work around guns a lot, but whose professional skill it is to exercise control in all situations and to resort to violence as the ultimate threat when they fear that they're going to lose control in a situation. And that really is what domestic violence is about.
Yeah, it really is. A lot of people think domestic violence has to do with anger and frustration. That really has nothing to do with it. It's all about control. It's about one person who feels that they have to exert supreme control over the other. And there's a lot of proof that was the relationship between David Brame and his wife Crystal.
And then the other issue that is really very much of a concern is this whole, you know, blue wall concept that, you know, police and police unions and guilds and police departments and police department press information and public information offices certainly, and many people in the media like to pretend that all police officers are superhuman, that they are all perfect, that nobody can make any mistakes. And when any allegations come forth, even internal to a department, let alone come out in the public, there's no accountability. And if there are any allegations of ongoing wrongdoing, there's rarely even any kind of an effort to stop the wrongdoing, because folks cannot admit that police officers are capable of making mistakes.
And they can't admit it among themselves. I mean, this was known among many, many, many police officers. It was basic office gossip that Brame had raped this woman in 1988, and there were many officers in the department who knew that he was having trouble at home, and I'm sure some of them who were his closest friends on the force knew that there was domestic violence going on. That can't occur without family members and friends knowing about it.
Yeah, and we're not talking about somebody here who's your colleague on the force. We're talking about somebody who's rising to the highest, most prestigious position of leadership within the department, the position that is most likely to get any kind of public scrutiny, so that the information is most likely to come out to the public. There's the greatest risk of exposure. And, you know, even with all of that, nobody was willing to step forward. Nobody was willing to wave some flags in front of people who could make a difference, such as the Tacoma City Council, which also bears some responsibility for this, mm-hmm. And say, you know, this is an incredibly dangerous situation to David Brame's wife and also to the citizens of Tacoma, who shouldn't have a police department which is being led by a guy like this.
Right. And it's Tacoma City Council that will be doing the investigation into this.
Yeah, they'll be looking at the role of Ray Corpus, the city manager who hired Brame. They want to look and see, you know, was this misfeasance? Did he do something wrong and not looking at his personnel file?
And
I think the answer to that is obviously yes. And then what should they do about it? Now, there's a vigil that's going to occur on Tuesday at 5 p.m. outside of the city council chambers in Tacoma, and there are women's groups who are trying to organize victims of domestic violence to go in and to give testimony in the open city council meeting on Tuesday evening to city council members to try to push them to actually do something about it, to really look at what is the process for hiring a police chief. Are there problems with the police department in Tacoma? Shouldn't there be a deeper investigation? Right now, the only group that's investigating the Tacoma Police Department and this whole process and how Brame was handled from his hiring through his end is the Washington Association of Sheriffs. And there's some concern that they will look at it and say, well, nothing substantial was wrong, and just dismiss it.
Well, let's hope the Tacoma City Council gives a little more time and energy into this than perhaps the Seattle City Council would, where someone like Jim Compton, who allows all of like 20 minutes at public hearings for, you know,
one or two people
incidents.
To testify.
Yeah.
Right.
And one of the other aspects of this as well is that, you know, if this were, for instance, a race-related incident, you know, the shooting of an African American or something, there would be the possibility of having fallback on quote unquote civil rights violations, which is always an interesting euphemism when somebody's been murdered. But, you know, when you have violence and domestic violence situations, you have an entire class of people that is most frequently the victims, women and sometimes children. And yet it is never seen as a systemic thing. You know, the things like the vigil in front of city council chambers in Tacoma, it's not just a women's issue. Men have to take responsibility for men's violence also, and it's something that that too many men or women willing to look the other way and say, well, that's not something that concerns us.
Right.
It is something that concerns all of us.
Right. Women will talk about this and talk about this and talk about this and agitate and agitate and agitate for change, but it's really men that have to say to the guys who are the abusers, you can't do that. That's wrong. It has to be their buddies. It has to be their friends. It has to be their brothers, their fathers that have to come down on them and say, that's not, you can't do that.
Well, and finally, one of the key things in getting any accountability in the police departments seems to be a lack of transparency and being able to see what goes on internally.
Yeah, yeah. If there had been a civilian review board or even just a single civilian among the city itself that was keeping a close eye on what was going on in the Tacoma Police Department, then it's likely this would not have come. It would not have come to this. I mean, back in 1988, when Brame raped this woman, there would have been a huge stink over it. If there had been a civilian review board, there would have been some place for the woman to go in order to get some kind of something done. At this point, I mean, when it actually happened, there really was nothing she could do. She complained, excuse me, she was a coworker of his. She complained to Internal Affairs, and yet, as you can see, it was all covered up. So there really was nothing done at that point. If there had been a civilian review board, he might not have been hired.
And because there are huge incidences of complaints of sexual harassment and sexual discrimination within the Seattle Police Department, and there are no outside mechanisms for accountability in the Seattle Police Department, you wonder how many powder kegs are
waiting
in our own police
yeah.
department, waiting to explode.
Exactly.
You know, relating to that, I get the biweekly notices of the committee at Seattle City Council, the police, fire, courts, and technology.
Yeah.
And I know coming up this Wednesday, one of the items is reducing the OPA reports from quarterly to just semi-annually. That they come forward and give these reports. It's like,
well, that's because because the price of bleach is going up and up.
It seems like it, you know, at a time when we need more scrutiny. You know, they're probably for reasons they'll say is because of budget cuts. You know, we need to reduce those.
Or we need to concentrate on the war on terrorism. Homeland Security.
Concentrate on transferring $570 million to Lake Union.
Yeah, if you really think about that, about the term Homeland Security, okay. Now, does that mean protecting ourselves from terrorist attacks, or does that mean protecting ourselves from the terrorist at home, the man who's trying to control and beat mom? I mean, really, what is Homeland Security here?
Well, what is national security issues as well.
What are national security issues?
Anyway, speaking of which, I was really elated to read this week that the war is over. They're going to be bringing troops back.
By that, I didn't think you were going into that, but can I throw in one other related thing on the Homeland Security issue?
Can I stop you?
I'm sure you can. But the thing down in suburban Tacoma this morning in Parkland, where the 16-year-old boy was 2 pounds of plastic, not plastic explosives, but basically the same sort of chemicals that Robert Reed had on his shoe, were discovered in this kid's apartment. And there's a priceless quote on this in this morning's Times, I believe it was, saying something to the effect of, this isn't a case of terrorism so much as it is parents who are not paying careful attention to what their children were doing on the internet. Now, it does raise the question of how much money we're spending on Homeland Security if you can, you know, just get all this information and material over the internet. But it also raises the question that if you look at the address in Parkland that this is at, it's right next to McCord Air Force Base. And you know, once again, we have the question of not only what our people in our military families, the men in our military and law enforcement families, learning in terms of transferring their violence skills to their home situation, but what are their kids learning in terms of weaponry and in terms of making things go boom and the excitement of all that. So.
All right, well, finally, one more tied to Homeland Security. I also saw this week where the local librarians continue to show more spine than the rest of our elected leaders combined.
Is that books spine? Is that
there's a little pun there. where they are going to issue... on their books, not on the books, the...
on the bookmarks.
Bookmarks. Mm-hmm. Notices that two people that come to the library, that the FBI may be asking for lists of whatever you might be checking out or looking at or perusing. You know, just
I also want to mention that the Seattle Public Library is doing something that many libraries are doing around the country, which is as soon as you bring a book back, they're erasing the fact that you took it out from their system. I think that's a really good policy. And the Seattle Public Library, along with a lot of other libraries, want to maintain some kind of confidentiality so that people will feel free to read whatever they want. It's a basic freedom. And anything that's in the Seattle Public Library should be available to any citizen who wants it. And people should not feel restricted because they think the FBI might have some access to what they're reading. So the Seattle Public Library is regularly purging their records of what people check out.
Or more to the point, that they'll get in trouble because of what they're reading.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right, so speaking of what we're reading in the papers, if you believe it, the war apparently is over in Iraq and Afghanistan.
because George Bush says it is, therefore it's over.
However, U.S. troops are still shooting on the bad guys. In this case, the bad guys are Iraqi demonstrators, unarmed civilians.
People who don't want the United States telling them essentially the United States running their country.
Yeah, just this week there were three demonstrations in Fallujah. The first one was on Monday. Residents had marched to a school that U.S. troops had taken over only 4 days earlier and were demanding that U.S. troops leave the school so that it could reopen so, gosh, their kids could actually get an education. Well, this demonstration started at 9 p.m. at night. There were about, estimates differ, between about 100 to 200 people there. U.S. soldiers on the scene said that demonstrators were firing at the building with AK-47s, and that's why they opened fire. However, reporters on the scene, both an Associated Press reporter and a reporter for The Independent in the U.K., say that when they examined the building where the U.S. troops were based, the school, they found absolutely no, they found no bullet holes. That they were taken upstairs to the opposite side of the building and shown a window that had been shot out from a separate direction. That is what the U.S. military had to had produced as evidence that the demonstrators were shooting at them before they fired. Now, these same reporters went down to the street level and they looked at the houses across the street from the school, and they saw what looked like sprays of bullets and automatic weapons fire that were directed at the demonstrators. Some 15 people were killed, as many as 65 to 80 people were wounded in that attack. The next day, demonstrators...
Winning hearts and minds once again.
Right.
Yeah.
The next day, demonstrators marched again to protest the earlier shooting the day before and were again fired on by U.S. troops. Two people were killed and many, many, many were wounded. And then in Mosul, on the same day as the first shooting in Fallujah, demonstrators were shot at again. Now, Mosul has seen a lot of unrest. There are many, many people in the city who want the U.S. military to leave. The U.S. came in and put a mayor in place that nobody in Mosul recognizes, and that a week ago, when he gave his first speech to, when this mayor gave his first speech to a crowd of Mosul residents, they started to boo him.
Yeah, and this is a sizable city too. This is not a small town.
Yeah, and U.S. troops opened fire on the crowd in that situation. So what we're seeing is that the war is far from over, but it's a war against the Iraqi people, and it's a war against Iraqi people who don't like the U.S. presence in Iraq.
And you know, we continued to have this whole whole tendency within the Bush administration to say that that, you know, reluctance among Iraqis to accept the United States leadership, and the fact that the United States has been parachuting in all of these various leaders of ministries and various other, you know, they're trying to build democracy from the top down, basically, and they're doing it with people that have no constituency, no recognizability, no credibility among the Iraqi people. And when the Iraqis respond to this, you know, rightfully resentful, the Bush administration and some figures within the Pentagon have been saying, well, the Iranians are prompting them. They're taking their lead from the Shiite clerics in Iran, which is, you know, is just flatly ridiculous.
It's
but
bull.
It really is a setup for ongoing attacks against people in Iraq. I mean, you know, it's not going to be too much longer before, you know, the demonstrators and Saddam's remnants become terrorists. Well, these are terrorists, and we're trying to mop up, you know, terrorist attacks in within the country of Iraq.
And you have to understand, too, why troops are actually firing on demonstrators. Now, they wouldn't do that here at home in the same situation, but they're doing it in Iraq because they're afraid that some of the rocks that demonstrators are throwing, and many of the demonstrators are taking their cue from the Palestinian uprising in the West Bank and Gaza, and they're throwing rocks at U.S. troops and U.S. trucks and tanks, etc. But the troops are worried that some of those rocks are going to be grenades, because in a couple of instances they have been grenades. And just after the U.S. troops fired on demonstrators in Iraq in Fallujah for the second time, a few hours later a couple people came back and threw grenades into the same compound. And seven U.S. troops were injured. U.S. troops are worried about suicide attacks, suicide bombers, and suicide vehicles being blown up. That was the same situation, if you'll recall, in Lebanon in the 1980s.
Yeah. If you 1983.
Yeah,
actually.
1983, yeah. when a U.S. Marine barracks was blown up by a suicide car bomber. So
with 240 some casualties,
right? With a lot of people killed. So this is a worry when you occupy a country, that the residents are going to be unhappy with that, and you're going to be subject to grenades being thrown at you and suicide attacks. That's happening in the West Bank and Gaza. It's happening here in Iraq.
Yeah, and so what we're seeing is a setup really for almost the same type of cycle that we see in Israel and Palestine, where you get the same sort of skittishness on behalf of an occupying army, and then you get
these gross human rights abuses.
You get these gross human rights abuses, and then you get the Iraqi people, as with the Palestinians before them, treating the people who've fallen, and we've already seen it with the slain demonstrators this week, as martyrs toward a greater and long-running cause. And, you know, we're going to start to get this adulation of the martyrs to the cause, and that's a setup for more extremist groups with suicide bombings and all of the other dynamics that have gone with that. It's really a setup for a very ugly situation that the United States has not adequately prepared itself for.
All right. Well, that continues. On the bright side, I guess now that the war is over, I can expect on the economic side that my 401k should be going
well,
through
no,
the roof.
Well, no, you're going to get another war. I spent my May Day out at a wonderful KVI event out in an evangelical church in Bothell, and one of the questions for the panel, which was, you know, some of us and the KVI air staff from moderator Kirby Wilbur, was, well, now that Iraq has been liberated, who's next? And so maybe that's one of the economic answers, is that we'll just keep invading countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, a lot of people are surprised that, gosh, you know, the economy hasn't recovered. The war didn't help the economy any. Well, wars don't help the economy.
They help a handful of people, but they don't help an economy.
No, and I mean, the economy has much, much deeper problems that a war is not going to solve. The major problem is an overcapacity of goods, of economic goods, and a squeeze on the corporate bottom line that will not be alleviated by huge budget deficits, as the Bush tax cut plan is going to run up. And also a problem with heavy unemployment and low consumer spending, and that's not being helped by the war either. So the basic issues of the Bush tax cut plan, which is supposed to stimulate the economy, will actually add another nail to the coffin, in my opinion. And we could see things like rising inflation without a corresponding... Inflation usually goes up for two reasons. Either the economy is recovering and so consumer prices can go up and wholesale prices can go up, or in the case that I'm looking at, you've got huge budget deficits and a weak dollar, and that can drive inflation up because imported goods will go up in price, and that will be much, much worse for the economy. That's a very bad situation, spiraling inflation when the economy is weak.
Yeah, and also spiraling inflation with a massive deficit, where much of the money that the government is spending that it doesn't have isn't going into, for instance, workforces. It's going to the stockholders of company like Halliburton and Bechtel.
Right, it's going to the wrong people. It's not going to go to the sector of the economy that will boost consumer spending. It's not going to pay state and federal employees who could keep spending their money and help to boost the economy. It's not doing any of that. It's going to the people who already have too much money, have already maxed out on their spending, and so they can't really boost the economy any.
Didn't I see something also this week about Bush trying to nix overtime pay for federal employees? Anybody catch that?
He had a number of whoppers this week. He also had a great one about there being any number of possible repositories of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that we could be able to exploit in the future, which I thought was an interesting turn of phrase.
I also want to just get in here quickly before we end that the U.S. is now officially a sponsor of terrorism, according to our own definition. The group that Saddam Hussein, the only terrorist group that Saddam Hussein used to sponsor, which is, I believe their name is Muqtada al-Islam or something like that, they're a group that's anti-Iranian, and they carry out armed incursions across the border into Iran. The Bush administration has reached a ceasefire with that group, and instead of bombing them into oblivion like they did with Ansar al-Islam, they have allowed this group to keep its weapons and to continue its armed incursions across the border into Iran. So now, I have to remind folks that this group is on the State Department's list of terrorist groups, that we are now officially a sponsor of terrorism.
Yeah, but only if it was Saddam Hussein's group. The kind of moderate the wave of moderates in Iran that we've seen over the last number of years that have increasingly been introducing freedoms into the political system in
Iran,
including free and fair democratic elections in Iran. The United States should not be threatening to invade that country and labeling it an axis of evil. That should be a model for the rest of the Muslim world, and it's not. Meantime, you've got explosives and terrorist weaponry being found in suburban Tacoma, so maybe we should be bombing there.
So you have to wonder if there's going to be like a little symbol or logo for official sponsor of terrorism, kind of like they do for like the Olympics, where they put on different products.
Right.
Well, it's the old, is it a terrorist? Is it freedom fighter?
You could stick one on the flag, these little flags that people put on their SUVs.
Oh, I thought you meant like where the 50 stars were.
All right. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
It is a public... Oh, we're going to hear on that last one.
Make sure you give you a phone number.
What I thought she was saying is, it's a fine publication that comes out every other week around town, where you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, and whatnot. Also on the internet at www.eatthestate.org. You can certainly volunteer for Eat the State, or send in donations, or subscribe, or give story tips, or any number of good, fine things. All that can be done by leaving a message at our voicemail, which is area code 206-903-9461.